Fancy a game?
I would hope you just explain math to them.
What? Like we're too self-referential.
Is that how analytics work?
I think I did my math right.
I do not trust your math at all.
Technically correct.
And people call us smug.
With Tyler Bischoff.
Hello, Ryan Tannehill. The Golden Knights managed to give up the first three goals of a game again. They have strange logic for fixing their play. UNLV escaped with a win in what would have been the worst loss in about 20 years at least for UNLV basketball. But we start with the NFL because the NFL playoffs, it gave me one reason for optimism for the Raiders and one major reason for pessimism for the Raiders. I'll start with the optimistic side. The Tennessee Titans are playing in the AFC Championship game. The Titans finished 9-7, only two more wins than the Raiders this last season. And if you look at DVOA, they were sixth on offense in the regular season for DVOA. They were 16th on defense. So they were dead average, middle of the league when it comes to their defense. The Raiders, ninth in offense for DVOA this year, pretty solid, close to what the Titans were, 31st in defense. So you take the Titans. You can also throw the Packers and the Chiefs in there because both of those teams are not in the top 10 by DVOA for defense. And you don't have to have a dominant defense to be in the Final Four in the NFL. You need to have one side of the ball be really good, which is what the Packers and Chiefs and the Titans, they're sixth in DVOA. All three of them have been very good on offense this season and average, slightly above average on defense. So if you're the Raiders and you look at the last basically 20 years of your franchise, you've been terrible on defense for pretty much every single season. And you look at the John Gruden era, you've been terrible on defense the last two seasons. So you have to get better on defense. But the good news is you don't have to be one of the 10 best defenses in the NFL. You just have to get to average. And while I don't think the Raiders are going to be an average NFL defense next year, I think it, like, best case scenario, they're going to be the 21st best defense in football or something like that. It's not impossible to think they could take a jump up to 16th or 17th in DVOA and be, you know, an average NFL defense, and that could be enough to get there. So there's optimism when you look at the Tennessee Titans sitting in the AFC Championship game and think, huh, the Raiders aren't that far away from the Titans. Like, you look at the Ravens and you're like, okay, the Raiders are nowhere close to the Ravens. But you look at the Titans and you're like, eh, they're not that far off from that team, right? Like, it wouldn't take that much to be the Titans, right?
Is there... I know we keep harping on this, but is there a Tannehill that they could...
Yeah, I don't know. That's... I mean, if you look at the regular season, that's the big thing offensively that's different between the Raiders and the Titans. But if you look at the playoffs, Tannehill hasn't broken 100 yards, right? In either of the playoff games. Hasn't he been under 100? Like, the Titans are winning playoff games by spitting on analytics. Right, analytics are like, you got to pass the ball, passing's efficient, and they're like, no, we're going to give it to Derrick Henry, and he's going to run for 180 yards. And it's worked twice in a row. It's been success, and against the Patriots and the Ravens. Like, they've beaten two good teams by doing that. So they're basically...
Well, you got to sell out to stop Tannehill.
That's true. They're basically just dumping on analytics. And so is there a Tannehill? No. Like, the chances of you finding the next Ryan Tannehill, like, there's probably not going to be the next Ryan Tannehill for another decade. Guy who's an average quarterback at one stop, goes somewhere else, and is now one of the five best quarterbacks in football, which is what he's been this year. So it probably not. But what they've done in the playoffs, it hasn't been because of Tannehill. It's been now Tannehill and A.J. Brown in the regular season give you reason to be scared, but they haven't actually done anything in the playoffs. It's been, hey, we're going to give Derrick Henry the ball 1,000 times, and he's going to run for 180 yards, and we're going to win the game. And listen, if you look at the Raiders roster construction, that's kind of what they're going for. They're kind of going for, hey, let's give it to Josh Jacobs a lot.
I was just going to say, and the advantage of Derrick Henry is he doesn't have a damaged shoulder. Yeah, that they're making him play
not
through.
Not playing with a fractured shoulder. That does help. So, like, the defense is way off. I don't think the defense will actually be at that level next season. But there is reason to look at the Titans and say, oh, okay, the Raiders could actually do that. They could be at the Titans level next year. But the big reason for pessimism and one of the big differences between the Titans and the Raiders and their standings in the AFC, I don't think there's any chance the Raiders can beat the Chiefs. I do not think they can catch that team. A key for the Titans, good, they were a wild card team, but a key for the Titans, they play in the AFC South. Like, they got to beat the Texans, the Colts, and the Jaguars, right? They don't really have a great team in that division that they have to beat. The Raiders basically have two scheduled losses with Kansas City. And listen, the optimism on Kansas City is Pat Mahomes, next year will be the last year of his rookie contract. So after that season, conceivably, they've got to give him a massive deal and they get to spend less money elsewhere. So conceivably, the rest of the team takes a hit. But the Raiders can't cover the Chiefs. The Raiders can't cover Travis Kelce. They can't cover Tyreek Hill. They can't cover anything because, I mean, they didn't have, what did Mecole Hardman have the 60-yard touchdown against the Raiders in week two or whatever that was? Like, it's, they can't cover Pat Mahomes' receivers. And you throw in the fact that Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce are just freaks. Like, you can't cover that. So while I'm optimistic watching the Titans and being like, all right, the Raiders aren't far from that, They can't catch the Chiefs.
The Chiefs are the moon.
They're not going to catch the Chiefs. And even if the Titans beat the Chiefs this weekend, it's still like over a 16-game schedule. You're not going to catch the Chiefs. The Chiefs had like, I think you'd consider it a down regular season.
Yeah, it wasn't very good.
They won 12 games, and they're hosting the AFC title game. So Titans give you reason for optimism.
They started Matt Moore for a couple of those.
They did. Titans gives you reason for optimism, but the Chiefs being in the division, it hurts. It hurts a lot. Like, I don't know how, if you're the Raiders, you actually, in one offseason, catch up to where the Chiefs are, especially where your defense is. So, I don't know. Pessimistic on that end.
Tom Brady?
Maybe. Can he be Ryan Tannehill?
No.
Yeah, I don't think so either. That's a strange sentence to say out loud. Now... on free agency, the Raiders probably need like...
the best quarterback we've ever seen.
Is not Ryan Tannehill.
Not as good.
If we look at free agency, the Raiders probably need to get like 8 new defensive starters or something like that. That needs to be the focus of the offseason. They don't have that many good defensive players. But we're going to look at the offensive side of the ball. That's way more fun. The Raiders have 4 wide receivers under contract for the 2020 season. Tyrell Williams, Hunter Renfrow, Zay Jones, and Marcel Aitman. Renfrow's cap hit is under $1 million. He's terrific value. He'll be back, no doubt about it. The other 3, the Raiders could get rid of all of them, and there's no dead cap hit. Tyrell Williams actually has an $11 million salary for next year, but it's not guaranteed. They can cut him, and it doesn't even count against the cap for them next season. So Tyrell Williams could very much be gone this offseason for the Raiders if they find somebody to replace him. Zay Jones, Marcel Aitman, they don't make a whole lot of money, so they could be back, depending on what the Raiders actually like out of those two. But here's my, I don't know if it's concern is the right word, but what do you think the chances are the Raiders, A, sign a free agent wide receiver that they think, like, a big name wide receiver in free agency, and B, draft a wide receiver in the first round?
Honestly, I think they'll sign a wide receiver. I don't think it'll be a big name guy, and I don't think they'll draft one in the first round.
Really? So you don't think they'll go either way with a wide receiver? I think they're absolutely doing one of the two.
I mean, Antonio Brown's available. So
every single time John Gruden talked about Derek Carr, he mentioned that he doesn't have a wide receiver. Like, I think there's no way they don't either sign a big name one or draft one.
I think they'll sign one for sure, but I don't think they're drafting one.
So I'm a little bit afraid that they're going to try to do both. That they're going to try to sign one in free agency and draft one. Now, if we look at the ones they could sign, these are the free agent wide receivers that you'd consider as like, yeah, that's your number one guy. Amari Cooper, AJ Green, Robbie Anderson, Emmanuel Sanders, and Antonio Brown. There are other guys that you could argue could turn into number ones, but they're probably not ones you'd sign and say, oh yeah, he's our number one receiver. There's other guys that are like Tyrell Williams last year who are like, all right, he was good as a number two. We sign him, make him our number one, see what he does. There's guys you could make that argument for, but those 5 guys are the ones that you look at and say, okay, we can sign him, and he steps in as our number one receiver. Amari Cooper would be hilarious if they signed him. So would Antonio Brown. So neither of those are likely to happen. So you're left with AJ Green, Robbie Anderson, and Emmanuel Sanders. I think Robbie Anderson has to be the number one target of those 3. He's 26. Sanders is 32. AJ Green is 31. He's younger. There's less of a chance that you're getting the drop off simply from age. And if you look at their career numbers, AJ Green's better than the other two by far, but he didn't play at all this last season. What did he play? 9 games the season before? Like, AJ Green we haven't seen this guy play very much in the last two seasons, and he's 31.
Also, Raider, like Bengals to Raider, has not been a recipe for success.
No, it has not. That is a good point. It has not.
Carson Wentz, Vonta's perfect. It's just sort of a. It's not
Carson Wentz.
Carson Wentz. Sorry, Carson Palmer.
Carson Wentz available?
I mean, his injury history, maybe.
Maybe. So, to me, Robbie Anderson is the wide receiver they should be trying to get. He was 7th in the NFL in air yards per target, and he's been, in his 4-year career, he's been top 3 in that stat twice. He is a deep threat, and adding him would eliminate any sort of excuse for Derek Carr and John Gruden when it comes to throwing the ball down the field, and any excuse for not having explosive plays. Like, Robbie Anderson is a deep threat. You put him out there, and there's a reason to throw it deep. There's a reason to call plays to throw it deep. So you sign him. He's a potential number one option. But here's my issue. If you do sign a Robbie Anderson or an A.J. Green or something like that, to me, you cannot draft a wide receiver number one or in the first round. You can't do it because you have so many holes on defense that you have to spend either draft capital or free agency salary cap money on defensive players. You cannot go first-round wide receiver and sign a Robbie Anderson. Like, that is a poor use of your cap space and draft capital to make this team better. The Raiders, you look at the offense, they spent a bunch of money on Trent Brown and Richie Incognito. They just gave him an extension. They have a first-rounder in Colton Miller, right? The offensive line, they've used a lot of salary cap space, a lot of draft capital. Running back, they used a lot of draft capital to go get Josh Jacobs. They locked up Darren Waller to a long-term deal. Like, you cannot do both at wide receiver. You cannot do free agency and the draft, because what you're doing is you'd be sacrificing your defensive talent to make up for Derek Carr's ineffectiveness. Because you can make the argument, hey, Derek Carr, if we get him two good wide receivers to throw in with Hunter Renfrow and Darren Waller, he's going to be awesome, and the offense is going to be awesome. Probably would be. If you get Robbie Anderson and LaVisca Chenault, one of the first-round wide receivers from Colorado or something, yeah, the offense is probably going to be awesome next year, but Derek Carr is the highest paid player on the offense. He's supposed to make up for some of those deficiencies. He's supposed to make up for that. So if you get a wide receiver, if you get Robbie Anderson in free agency, and then you draft a wide receiver in the first round, you're basically saying, we know Derek Carr can't do it. We know Derek Carr needs maximum help, and we're just going to suck it up on defense, which would be a terrible plan, an absolutely terrible plan. Like, Derek Carr at some point has to prove, hey, I can make up for not having two great wide receivers.
That does sound like a Grudenism, though. Like,
I know, that's what I'm afraid of.
Our defense is bad. We'll just score more points.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what I'm afraid of, is that he's going to look at the offense and say, oh, God, I can get Robbie Anderson and LaVisca Chenault or whoever they want in the first round, whatever guy they like, and that's what they're going to do. And instead of getting defensive starters, that's what they're going to do.
So you basically go get Robbie Anderson, and then you have the other, three, because Hunter Renfrow is slot.
Yep,
he is slotted into the slot.
You're good to go.
And then just hope one of the other three wide receivers under contract turns into a number two.
Yeah, or, I mean, you can draft a wide receiver in, the third round or the fifth round or whenever they have their other picks and see if those guys work out. But, yeah, that's the thing. Like, Tyrell Williams, if they sign Robbie Anderson, they might cut Tyrell Williams just because they save $11 million and you can probably get his production cheaper. But, yeah, I mean, the hope would be, hey, we got Robbie Anderson, Darren Waller, and Hunter Renfrow. We'll figure out the rest of it, right? It'll be Alan Lazard for the Packers, right? Mecole Hardman for the Chiefs. We'll find somebody else that can be the fourth option in the passing game. Like, that's what you'd be hoping for at that point, is that, okay, it can be Marcell Aitman. Zay Jones can be our fourth best option at wide receiver if we have Robbie Anderson, Hunter Renfrow, and Darren Waller. That's at least what I would hope they would do. Now, I kind of think they might go Robbie Anderson and draft one and say, all right, we're good. Don't have any linebackers on the team, but we're good to go. So that's my fear. If they sign somebody in free agency to a big contract, you cannot then draft one. You just can't do it. That shouldn't be allowed if you're the Raiders, because your defense is terrible.
What if you sign Robbie Anderson to a fairly large contract and then he immediately gets hurt? A la Isaiah Crowell.
Well, Crowell screwed him by getting hurt right after the draft.
Oh, okay.
So if he gets hurt right after the draft, you just screwed no matter what.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, if you sign him and, he tears his ACL right before the draft, and you're like, all right, we don't have this guy for the year, I guess you draft one.
All right. Because I was just like, you went and paid a guy to come be your, like, every down back, and then you immediately drafted a guy be your every down back.
I love Josh Jacobs. Penalty correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Go to BeConnectedSports.com to download the mobile sports app for quick and easy betting from your phone or tablet. You can bet before the game or while you watch with in-game wagering. It is the Be Connected Sports app from Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on LVSportsNetwork.com.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from BeConnectedSports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at BeConnectedSports.com.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
Allegiant Stadium construction has created 1,665 construction jobs.
So there is a story up at NevadaCurrent.com that is about the jobs created by the new stadium. That was one of the biggest selling points of the stadium, one of the reasons why the Nevada State Legislature agreed to give $750 million to the Raiders for a stadium was because it was going to create construction jobs.
$750 million of your money.
Now, aside from the fact that giving public money to create temporary jobs being stupid, it appears as though the stadium is not actually created the number of jobs that were promised. From the Nevada Current, the stadium was supposed to create 18,700 jobs. That was the initial projection. So far, there have been 1,655 full-time jobs created at the stadium. That is less than 10% of their projection. That is remarkably bad. The stadium is supposed to open in 8 months, and they've created 9% of the jobs they promised. Now, Brian Haynes, who's on the stadium authority, explained it to the Nevada Current like this. The community benefits report numbers measure the actual work hours for a limited group of employees, on-site construction workers, while the total jobs estimate includes a broader range of workers, such as support staff at construction companies, architects and engineers, and equipment and service suppliers. These workers don't enter the worksite and therefore aren't captured in the community benefits report, but they are nonetheless jobs created as part of the construction project. So the stadium authority promised 18,700 jobs. They now have a report for their meeting this week that says, it's only created 1,665. And the stadium authority is explaining that by saying, well, that 1,600 number is just the on-site construction workers. There's actually a lot more jobs that are created off-site, and we can't actually calculate those, but just trust us, they exist. Which is a good example of how all of the things they've projected for the stadium have gone.
Yep.
Here's what the stadium's going to do for you. Well, how do we know that's true? Well, you don't. You just have to trust us for it. It's like when they were estimating the economic impact. $620 million in economic impact for Nevada every single year. $100 million of that was because TV announcers would say Las Vegas Raiders.
And people would go, oh, Las Vegas. I should go to Las Vegas. I hadn't even heard of that place.
That's the implication. When you say that television announcers saying Las Vegas Raiders is going to drive more tourism to the city of Las Vegas, is that people would hear it and say, oh, that's a good place to go. Because
people love to go to Santa Clara.
Right. Because when you watch NFL games and you hear the New Orleans Saints, you're like, New Orleans. I should go there. Never thought of that before. That's not how it works. No one watches NFL games, hears the city name, and think, that'd be a great place to vacation. Doesn't happen. And even if it does, it's like six people.
Green Bay. I should really go up there.
So
preferably in winter.
They don't have any actual way to tell us how many jobs the stadium has created. They just say, hey, it was going to be 18,700. And we're just supposed to believe, even though at the end of the day, we're going to have like 2,000, 3,000 construction jobs on site. And that's the other part of this is even if I'm sure there are other jobs that were created that had nothing to do with people stepping on the construction site. But you're going to tell me that there are 16,000 other full-time jobs that have nothing with the people don't step on site? I can't believe that. I simply can't. You're going to tell me 2,000 people stepped on site and 16,000 people didn't.
Well, no wonder people keep reporting delays to the stadium. You need to flip those numbers.
Right. It'd be so much faster. The stadium would be done by now. So I can't believe that there are 16,000 people that have full-time jobs because of the stadium that have never stepped foot on stadium site.
Is it possible that they're like, we're going to need that many concession workers?
No, that's a separate projection.
Okay.
That's in the future.
I was hoping that
nope,
that...
that's in the future.
Oh, man. Jonathan Marchessault is back to practice for the Golden Knights.
We'll get more into the Golden Knights collapse later in the show. He has been back for a while, but Dave Shane of the RJs in Buffalo, he tweeted out that Jonathan Marchessault is skating with the top line again, which would conceivably mean for their game tomorrow that they don't have to play Alex Tuck or Chandler Stephenson on that top line, and they should get back to getting good production out of their top line. Riley Smith, William Karlsson, Alex Tuck generated one high danger chance in 13 minutes together on Saturday. One in 13 minutes. So, A, Alex Tuck still disappointing when given a chance to fill in on the top six. But B, you need Jonathan Marchessault back just so that first line actually looks good. But looking at the lines, Gerard Gallant finally demoted Cody Eakin to fourth line center. He played there on Saturday. According to Dave Shane, he's skating there with Will Carrier and Ryan Reeves in practice. It took until halfway into the third season, but Gerard Gallant finally moved Cody Eakin down. And guess what? In the game on Saturday, Cody Eakin set his Golden Knights career highs in Corsi and expected goals percentage while playing on the fourth line. Now, granted, they didn't create many chances. But what the fourth line does for the Golden Knights is kill time. And they kill time by not giving up goals, not even giving up chances. That's what they do. When the fourth line was on the ice on Saturday against the Blue Jackets, they gave up two total shot attempts. That's it. That's what they do. They go out there, they don't give up anything, and they don't really create anything, but they just kill time, let your top line, second line rest, and then when they get out there, those are the lines that are supposed to go score. Perfect role for Cody Eakin. Perfect role for Cody Eakin. So he's practicing there again. Probably going to be good in the future there.
I just am so happy. UNLV paid the second highest amount for buy games in the Mountain West.
So athleticdirectoru.com put together a list of all the bye games in college basketball. So Eastern Michigan comes to UNLV. UNLV pays them to come here and play a basketball game. UNLV spent $428,333 to pay teams to come play them this season. Only New Mexico spent more on bye games in the Mountain West. So UNLV paid five games this year. Purdue, Fort Wayne, Abilene Christian, Jackson State, Robert Morris, and Eastern Michigan. All those schools got somewhere between $80,000 and $90,000 total. The good news for UNLV is they did not lose a bye game this year. They did not pay somebody to come into Las Vegas and beat them. I do find it a little bit interesting, though, that UNLV had to spend so much on bye games. The average Mountain West school only had three bye games this year. Colorado State actually had the most at seven. But UNLV should be able to get good games, right? Like, that's sort of the assumption we make is, hey, UNLV's the... them and San Diego State, they're the Mountain West schools that can actually schedule good games, and yet UNLV went out and paid the second most amount in the conference. So, A, I do think a little bit of that is making the schedule easy for T.J. Otzelberger's first year, because it was an easy schedule in this first season in the non-conference anyways. So I do think some of that was, hey, let's make the schedule kind of easy for T.J. Otzelberger this year. And at the same time, you do have to pay schools to come play you. Like, if you want to schedule some wins like Eastern Michigan, you got to have to pay those schools to come there. Also, UNLV did get paid $20,000 to go play UCLA.
Nice!
Now, it is a home-and-home, so I assume UNLV has to pay them $20,000 next year.
Why wouldn't you just call it even?
They give them money, I don't know, for travel expenses or whatever.
All right.
I think most home-and-homes, they do actually have some sort of payment to the road team each year. You got to fly here now. Here's some money. We'll pay for your flights, basically. So they did get paid a little bit to go to UCLA and lose.
Again, you know my you know what I want us to do. I want us to be captain by game. Like, just, I want us to get paid to go play everybody. 13 road games. That's our non-conference. We will be the most well-funded swimming team in the history of college athletics. The Lady Rebels beat Wyoming 65-53.
They used a 13-0 run in the fourth quarter to come back and win back-to-back games. They've erased a fourth-quarter deficit with a big run. So the Lady Rebels were 4-7 in non-conference play. They're now 4-1 in the Mountain West. They sit in third. Fresno State's 5-0. San Jose State is 5-1. They play San Jose State this week, so they'll have a chance to claim second place. They got big wins over Boise State and Wyoming. Those are good Mountain West wins. Now they can beat another one, and it'll actually be at home. Or no, it'll be on the road. They got to go on the road and beat San Jose State. So both the men and the women are kind of having the same season where you're like, all right, not that fun of a non-conference schedule. Okay, they're 4-1 in Mountain West play. This might actually be good.
This is their fifth straight, right?
The women?
Yeah.
Fifth straight win?
Yeah.
Did they win their last non-conference game? I don't know. They've won four straight in conference play. I don't know if they won their last non-conference game or not.
All I know is they've all been like, check the game out in the third quarter and go, oh, they're screwed, and then get a tweet later that, oh, they won by 12. Oh, okay. Don't know how that happened.
Coming up, UNLV avoided what would have been their worst loss in 19 seasons in Laramie.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff on ESPN Las Vegas.
Marvin Coleman was the perfect symbolism for UNLV against Wyoming. Through the first 38 minutes, Marvin Coleman had more turnovers than points. Three turnovers, 2 points. He only taken one shot at that point in the game, and he was in foul trouble. Like, he did not have a good first 38 minutes of that game, and then Marvin Coleman became the most important player on the floor. He had a three-pointer to start a 7-0 run to force overtime. He had a three early in overtime that helped build UNLV's big lead, and he made 6 of 8 free throws in overtime to finish Wyoming off. Marvin Coleman went from nondescript performance to being the hero. And if you look at UNLV's game, Wyoming is terrible. That's the worst team in the Mountain West. That would have been the worst loss to by KenPom rankings in the KenPom era for UNLV. And for 38 minutes and 35 seconds, UNLV was outplayed. They were bad. And then Wyoming choked. And UNLV took full advantage of that. A minute 25 to play, Wyoming had just made a free throw to go up by 7. They then proceeded to miss 5 straight free throws to end regulation. They missed 5 straight free throws to end regulation, and UNLV scored on every single possession they had. A Marvin Coleman 3, a Nick Blair tip-in, and Donnie Tillman made 2 free throws, and their 7-point lead was gone in less than 80 seconds. That is an incredible job by Wyoming blow that lead.
That is a very efficient way to lose.
Pretty much all they had to do was make one of those 5 free throws. And yet they missed all 5 of them. And all they had to do was get one defensive stop on 3 possessions. They couldn't do that either. UNLV had to be perfect in the last 80 seconds, while Wyoming had to be whatever the exact opposite of perfect was, and both of those things happened. And then they got to overtime, and it's like UNLV realized, oh, Wyoming's really bad. We got this. No worries.
Wait, do these guys suck? Oh, cool. All right, let's just beat them.
One major takeaway from that game, Jonah Antonio might be back. He went last 6 games, Jonah Antonio was at 22% from 3. Not good. He hit 5 of 12 against Wyoming. 4 of 8 after halftime, too. He is the main reason that UNLV actually shot well in that game. They hit 34% of their threes. It's the first time in 6 games that they've hit over 30% of their threes. Hamilton was 2 for 4. Coleman was 2 for 3. They helped, but Amori Hardy was 1 of 10. Not good. But Jonah Antonio was excellent, hit 5 of 12, and got UNLV to a good 3-point shooting game. And beyond the simplicity of, hey, making 3-pointers is good, the way teams have to defend UNLV changes if Jonah Antonio and other guys on the team can make threes. Right? You go six straight games where you're shooting 25% of a team. Allen Edwards, Wyoming's head coach, in his halftime interview said the numbers say they can't shoot. Right? So teams are looking at UNLV and they say, oh, they're 250th in the country in three-point percentage. They're very, very bad from three. That's what we're going to make them do. And that's what Wyoming did. They played a zone defense for the majority of that game, and they kept the paint packed. Even when they were in man-to-man, they were playing off the shooters. They didn't care. Like, when you're defending in man-to-man, usually, if, say, the ball's on a wing and you're guarding the guy at the top of the key, you're sort of one pass away. So you're in a ball denial type of stance. Like, you don't want the guy to make an easy pass right there. But the way Wyoming played it, even when they were one pass away, they were just sagged into the paint. Like, they did not care that UNLV passed it around the perimeter and could take pretty much a three whenever they wanted. Like, UNLV turned down a lot of open threes in that game because in the first half, they couldn't make anything. So, like, Wyoming did not care that UNLV shot threes. And if you go back to the BYU game when UNLV didn't have Elijah Mitrelong or Jonah Antonio, BYU didn't guard UNLV outside the paint. Like, if it wasn't a Maury Hardy or Donnie Tillman, they did not care that Bryce Hamilton got a three or that Vitaly Scheeble got it. They just did not care. They cared about taking away layups for a Maury Hardy and Donnie Tillman. And that's what teams, BYU did it the most extreme, but Wyoming did it in that game as well. They said, hey, we do not want to give you layups to your best players. We're going to make you take jump shots. And so if Jonah Antonio is back to being a 35% three-point shooter, if you can get, just as a whole, if you can get some production out of Bryce Hamilton or Marvin Coleman or Vitaly Scheeble or Nick Blair, your team is going to become that much harder to defend. Because the way most teams are defending UNLV is, hey, beat us with open three-pointers. If you make some of those open three-pointers, you'll beat teams. That's what happened. Like, that's how UNLV came back and won in overtime. They hit two threes on the first two possessions of overtime. Right? Jonah Antonio, Marvin Coleman hit threes in overtime. It's like, all right, if you can hit threes, this team's going to be good enough offensively to win games. But the problem is we haven't actually seen for six games this team be capable of making threes. And even in this one, Maury Hardy was 1 of 10 from three-point range. He took 10 threes and made one. Like, that's terrible. So you've got to get... Maury Hardy's been in a slump for seven games now. You've got to get more out of him. At some point, you tell him, hey, you can't shoot that many threes, but you need a Maury Hardy to shoot. If they're going to play off of a Maury Hardy, those are shots he should be taking. He's just got to make them. Like, you got to make more than 10% of your threes. That would be helpful.
Was he at least, like, you know, hitting the rim, or was it really, like, knuckleball, knuckleball, knuckleball?
I don't remember a Maury Hardy having a bad miss. He probably had one because he took 10. But I don't remember. Like, Jonah Antonio's had some bad misses in the six-game stretch. He's had some where you're like, oh, yikes. That wasn't even close. But I don't remember Maury Hardy having many terrible shots. I'm sure he had one because he took 10, but I don't remember them being that awful. So, yeah, but you got to make threes. Like, that's what this team has to do, and at least we saw some of that. At least we saw Antonio doing that. He put stress on the defense. You can break the defense. Because there was one possession in the second half where Wyoming almost looked like they were in a box and one because they were playing their zone, but where Antonio was on the floor, the guy that was defending that area was stuck to Jonah Antonio. Like, he was no longer defending his area. He was just, oh, Jonah Antonio's in my area. I can't let him catch and shoot. So you start to stress the defense. You start to almost break the defense in a lot of cases if you have a guy that can shoot. And that's what Jonah Antonio can be for this team. So that's what they need him to be the rest of the season. Make 5 of 12 threes every now and then. You know, most of the time you're going to make 3 of 8 or something like that. Like, you're not going to get off 12, but when you do, make 5 of them. And when you only shoot 7, you know, make 3 of them. And that makes defenses respect you. That makes defenses worried, because a lot of times teams will play zone, and if you hit 1 3, they'll be like, ah, can't do it. We're done. We're out of this stupid zone. Like, that happens a lot. So a lot of times, if you can just hit 1 3 early against the zone, a coach will be afraid to go back to it because they don't want to give up the threes. Now, the first 38 minutes and 35 seconds of that game deserve a lot of criticism because UNLV was terrible. Wyoming went into that game ranked 299th in KenPom. The worst loss for UNLV in the KenPom era, which is the last 19 years, was to Nevada, who was ranked 270th back in 2014. They have only lost twice ever to teams ranked outside the top 250. They've never lost to a team ranked outside the top 300. And Wyoming was 299. They were right on the fringes of that 300 mark. So had they lost that game, even with it being on the road, it would have been the worst loss the UNLV has suffered in the KenPom era. The biggest problem for UNLV in the first half, their zone offense was horrendous. Wyoming mostly played this 3-2 zone, and UNLV they didn't know what to do. For some reason, listen, when you play a 3-2 zone, right, that means there's two guys on the bottom part of the zone. That means the corners and the baseline is what's open. And for some reason, UNLV just didn't put guys in the corners. They didn't put guys in the short corner. They didn't put guys in the post. Like, you should be overloading those two guys on the baseline, and UNLV didn't do it. If you go back to the non-conference season when they played Eastern Michigan, the last team that pretty much zoned them the whole time, granted, they were playing a 2-3, not a 3-2, but UNLV killed them with one pass. Top of the key or the wing, straight to the short corner, right? And then they had a 2-on-1 from there. Like, UNLV crushed Eastern Michigan zone. It was wonderful zone offense. I spent like 10 minutes telling you how great it was. They didn't do that but one time in the first half. That pass, they tried to make it one time in the first half, which makes no sense at all. Like, they should have been going to that pass the whole time, but they didn't. They did run a couple of plays to get guys sort of isolations in the short corner against the one man over there. So they did do a little bit, but for the most part, like, they did not take advantage of where the holes of that zone should have been. And I don't know. We've got the last two games they've played zone. One was excellent and one was terrible. And so teams are probably going to zone UNLV in the future. Like, there are going to be more teams that run a zone out against UNLV. They're not all going to be as bad as Wyoming. So you're going to have to be decent on offense in the first half. You can't be terrible for an entire half on offense and actually do it. So we'll see what happens. Like, and listen, we've talked a lot this season about, like, assigning blame, right? And I'm like, it's hard to find fault in what Otzelberger's doing. Like, his guys can't make layups, right? They're bottom 100 in the country and making layups, right? They can't make threes. They're almost bottom 100 and making threes. It's like, what's the coach supposed to do? But that game was about coaching too. Like, they did not run very much to exploit the weaknesses of that zone. They didn't do it. And so as much as I harp on the players haven't been good enough, the coaching wasn't good enough in the first half of that game. Like, the zone offense was terrible, and you can put a lot of blame on the coaching. They didn't make a lot of threes. Like, UNLV could have righted that ship by just knocking down some threes because they had open threes, but the coaching didn't actually get them in a great spot. So we'll see what teams do in the future, but they're going to get zoned again.
Hey, they won in overtime.
They did. Two straight now in overtime.
Oh, yeah. Well, wait, I thought the other one was double over.
Yeah, that's still overtime.
I know, but this is the first time they've won only having to utilize one overtime.
That's true, because Wyoming's very, very bad. I think that's what that comes down to. Wyoming is not good. Yes, they are. So UNLV 0-3 in non-conference play when going to overtime. Now 2-0 in conference play when going to overtime.
They just got to grind it out, man.
I guess they prepared themselves well by losing those overtime games. They learned how to lose in overtime. Now they're learning how to win in overtime.
Or they learned they can't do it. They need to exhaust the other team. It's the rope-a-dope.
It's actually, if you look at the teams they've lost to in overtime, they're just much better than the teams they've beaten in overtime. Fresno State, also not very good. I think they're 1-4 in conference play. They're better than that, but not that good of a team. Kansas State and Cincinnati, those teams are actually good. I mean, they're not going to make the NCAA tournament. Cincinnati might. But they're actually good. Like, they'd be like Mountain West champs. Fresno State's not winning the Mountain West. Wyoming might not win a Mountain West game this year.
Oh, man.
Because they don't get to play UNLV again and just zone them for 40 minutes and hope they miss all their threes.
Does Wyoming play Utah State?
I think so. I assume so. I mean, they play them at least once.
Okay. Well, somehow they'll win that game.
No. Utah State's about to turn it on. They're going to flip the switch. The switch will be flipped because they're going to start playing Carson Bischoff. Coming up next, the Golden Knights lost again at home. Four straight games, they fell behind 3-0, and they've got like the weirdest explanation of why they're no good.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler. Tyler Bischoff is
technically correct, the best kind of correct.
The Golden Knights managed to do it again. They gave up the first three goals of a game. They've done that four times in a row. This time they didn't even score to try and come back. They actually played well at the start of the game and then got shut down. The 3-0 loss to the Blue Jackets, though, was kind of a culmination of all the problems the Golden Knights have faced this season. They had bad goaltending. The Golden Knights only gave up 5 high danger chances in that entire game. The NHL average is 10, and they only gave up 5, and they still lost 3-0. The expected goals against was only 1.5. Fleury gave up 3, not good enough. Golden Knights dominated Corsi in expected goals percentage, 58% and 61%, right? They've been doing that all season, but couldn't finish. Obviously, they shot 0% because they didn't score, so unable to win despite having excellent analytics, and they give up a power play goal. This is a team that is top 10 in the league in terms of taking penalties and top 10 in the league in terms of allowing high danger chances while killing penalties. So pretty much everything we've talked about this year as being a problem for this team happened in that game. So the Golden Knights ended a 7-game homestand by losing 3 straight, and in the last 4 games, they fell behind 3-0. They got booed off the ice in the last 2 games of that homestand. And there's this strange narrative that to explain it, and it's that the homestand is too long. The RJ has a story up talking about it with the headline, "Golden Knights Hope Road Trip Serves as Antidote for Losing Skid." Gerard Gallant's mentioned it a couple of times. And Mark Stone gave this quote: "We just need to find our game again. Getting on the road, getting away, getting back to that simple hockey. Sometimes when you're at home, you take it for granted a bit. Maybe just a little bit too comfortable. I think being on the road could be a big help for us." Now, to back up what they're saying, this is the worst season the Golden Knights have ever had at home. This is their worst home record in franchise history. They have 10 losses in regulation at home. They had 12 last season, the entire year. They had 10 regulation home losses the whole year in year one. So they're losing more at home than they ever have. But still, too comfortable at home is bizarre. Home games are good across pretty much all sports, not just hockey. Every sport, home teams win more often than road teams. It's by a significant margin. And you look at the NHL this year, there are 16 NHL teams that are getting over 60% of their points when they're at home. There's only 9 that do it on the road. So being at home is excellent. Being at home is a good thing. Like, to take their argument to the extreme, if you had a 7-game playoff series and I told you they all had to be at one venue, would you rather they all be at home or all be on the road?
Home.
Taking their argument to the extreme, they're too comfortable to do that.
Oh, okay. So then, yeah, they need to play all road games.
They're too comfortable to play all these games at home in a row. They can't win. So I find that extremely odd. The idea of being too comfortable sounds more like, I don't know, the players can't handle it. I don't know. It's just a very strange argument to me that, oh, we've had too many home games.
They can't be sleeping in their own beds and play well.
Yeah. Like, the reward for having a good regular season in hockey is that you get home ice advantage in the playoffs. Like, that's a reward, and they're arguing that it's somehow a bad thing because they've been home too long and they've gotten too comfortable. It's just strange to me. Like, maybe the Golden Knights fans need to boo them more. Make them uncomfortable. Throw things at them while they leave the ice.
Is Elvis' helmet causing?
Still in action. Yeah, see, we can blame him as well.
Okay.
And Cody Eakin. They haven't won a game since Cody Eakin came back.
Oh, my God.
Just so we're aware. 0 wins since Cody Eakin has come back. So yeah, I listen.
That's so mean.
It is. It's very mean because it's by no means his fault. Like, he played fourth line on Saturday. He did exactly what the Golden Knights want the fourth line to do, and they didn't score. Like, when you're fourth line center, you're not there to score.
You're there to go get penalties.
And they only gave that's true. And they only gave up 2 shot attempts while the fourth line was on the ice. Like, Cody Eakin was not to blame for that loss, but they are 0-3 since he came back.
Me.
Call up Nick Waugh. He might be the answer there. I am curious if they're gonna play. They don't play another home game until, like, I don't know, the first week of February or something like that, because they've got 4 on the road, then you get the All-Star break, and then when they come back, it's 4 away from home. So it's the next 8 games are on the road, 4 straight, and then the All-Star break, and then 4 more. So I'm very curious how they play in these 4 games to end this unofficial first half of the season, just because They're saying they can't play at home. They're too comfortable. They need to play simple hockey, and getting on the road will help them do that. So that'll be strange. Oh, by the way, also, very, very fun. Gerard Gallant's going to coach the Pacific Division in the All-Star game because at the halfway point of the season, the Golden Knights were in first place by points percentage. They're currently in fifth place by points percentage. If they, like, only get a couple of points in these next four games, they're not going to be in the playoff picture, and Gerard Gallant's going to be coaching them in the All-Star game.
Perfect.
It is spectacular. It's my favorite thing. The Gerard Gallant will be it'll be like the 10th best team in the Western Conference. Ah! He's an All-Star game coach. That's the Pacific Division for you.
That's just flat out weird.